Get your gear ready. This is a Sherpa's Guide to Innovation.
This is a Sherpa's Guide to Innovation, a podcast dedicated to guiding you along your innovation expedition. I am Ben Tingey, your host. In addition, Jay Gerhardt joins me again. Good morning, Jay.
Hey, Ben. Good to see you. You know, we've got another milestone I wanted to point out for us. Oh. Don't know if you know this, but our teaser trailer for Sherpa's Guide to Innovation went up October 10th, 2017. We are recording this on October 9th of 2020. So we are, I'm going to call that, we're on our 3-year anniversary.
That's amazing. That's amazing. What a journey it's been. Well, very excited about today's guest. Today's guest is Taddy Hall, senior partner at Lippincott. Taddy had the fortune of being in Professor Clay Christensen's very first Harvard Business School class, and they maintained a close relationship ever since. In fact, Taddy was a co-author with Clay Christensen on the book Competing Against Luck, The Story of Innovation and Consumer Choice. As a global authority on innovation, Taddy helps clients drive growth and develop new products using Jobs to be Done and other innovation tools. He's a frequent writer and contributor for Harvard Business Review, The Wall Street Journal, Time Magazine, Huffington Post, and much more. Taddy, welcome to a Sherpa's Guide to Innovation podcast.
All right. Thanks, Ben. It's like awesome to be here with you guys.
We're thrilled. We're thrilled. This is going to be great. A quick note to our listeners, please like, share, and subscribe to this podcast. You can connect with us on LinkedIn, or you can find us on Twitter at SherpaPod. And then we'd also encourage you to follow the other exceptional healthcare podcasts on the Health Podcast Network, which you can find on Twitter at HealthPodNet. All righty. So Taddy, we have a standard opening question that we like to use with our guests. And so feel free to have some fun with this one. I wanted, so fill in the blanks here.
Okay.
I wanted to be a blank when I grew up. Now I'm a blank and they both blank.
I was pretty sure I was going to be a professional soccer player all the way through college, which was highly delusional. so delusional that I didn't even look for a job when I was in college. So, and now I'm a creative consultant. I think they both would be a lot of fun, but since I never actually played professional soccer, I can't really vouch for that. They certainly both involve a lot of juggling, though.
Juggling, yes.
And soccer requires creativity.
Yes, it does. That's well said, Jay. And so now most of my soccer is just watching my daughters play. But in any event, if you ask my wife, she'd say the delusional part's still there.
Awesome. You don't quite yet have that school of experience playing professional soccer.
No.
Well, Taddy, could you tell our listeners a little bit about Lippincott and your role there? The website says that Lippincott is a different kind of consulting firm, and that it uniquely combines strategic rigor with bold creativity, and it lists expertise in areas like brand and innovation, design, experience, things like that. What's up at Lippincott, and what do you do for them?
I can tell sort of my personal journey. I joined Lippincott a little over 3 years ago. It was a time where I'd been at Nielsen, the Nielsen company before that, and it was right after the book came out, and Nielsen was going through some transitions, and the CEO was leaving. Just felt like an interesting time to explore. And I just went out and spoke to a lot of firms because I'd been at Nielsen for six years and thought it'd be an interesting time to look around. And I literally walked into Lippincott and felt like this place is crazy, you know? And I never, you know, I've been in hundreds, probably thousands of different companies. You feel it when you talk to people, but I'd never been in a place that had more diverse types of genius and brilliance. And specifically, we have incredibly deep data analytics side of the house and the most mind-expanding creative teams that I've ever met. And bringing those two things together, I think has been the secret to Lippincott for its 75-year history. And the roots of the firm have always been at sort of the intersection of design and customer experience. The original founders of the firm really coined the concept of corporate identity, creating brands that we all know and love, like Sprite and Duracell Battery, designing iconic things like the Campbell's soup can that, you know, Andy Warhol made famous. And then, you know, more recently involved in major transformations of brands from, you know, Walmart to Starbucks, McDonald's, you can go down the list, but it's an amazing list of companies that Lippincott has helped in a very unique way. And I think it's really that intersection of deep analytical strength and unmatched creativity. And it really comes together, at least in my work, in the way that we think about brand and innovation in a highly integrated way. And that brand isn't simply like, you know, logos and ads and, you know, visual systems and voice. And innovation isn't simply products and services and business models. But then when those things come together and intersect, what you find is the connective tissue is really the language of customer experience and the way that products and services actually create new meaning in the lives of customers. And so the essential unit of almost everything we do, and it may involve product innovation, service innovation, new business models, it always grounds itself in this notion of, well, how are we transforming customers' experience and enabling progress and creating desired experiences that were either difficult or impossible in the past? And with an eye to doing that in a way that brings new meaning into their lives.
As you were talking about that, I was thinking about our last podcast episode where we were talking about the conversation we had with Bob Mesta, and he grilled me pretty well about the Tesla Model Y. Yeah, he will do that very well. It's a lot of fun. But I think about Tesla, as you talk about that, that seems like a fusion of innovation and brand. They go hand in hand, and they don't even really, I don't think they market, do they? I mean, with Elon, they don't have to, but
yeah,
is that the kind of integration that you're talking about?
And Tesla is what we would call a go-to brand. Go-to brands do some magical things. We all have a handful of them in our lives. I'll tell you just a funny story, hopefully funny. You can decide if it's funny or not. But I was speaking at a conference in Lisbon in Portugal just before the kind of COVID shutdown, and it was in February. And there was an executive there from Walmart Global who I got to know, and he had a Tesla hat on. And I just jokingly said, you know, at some point, you know, how long have you been in the Tesla marketing department? And he sort of laughed, and I was like, were you a big car guy? And he's like, I hate cars. I've always hated cars. I'm not a car guy. I'm a Tesla guy. And he talked about all the things that he hated about cars. You know, the process of buying them, the process of maintaining them, the process of replacing them. And he talked about all those things that he hated about owning cars. And then he talked about how Tesla had really quite systematically, almost like they were reading his mind, identified all those things he hated about owning a car and just engineered those out of his life and seamlessly embedded them into the Tesla ownership experience. Wow. And his story ended with, you know, my first Tesla recently came off of lease and I had replaced it. And everything, you know, with Tesla is online. And the Tesla fellow actually showed up with the new car and delivered it to him at his house in California. And, you know, gave him, you know, the keys and took a few minutes. And as my friend's name was Roth, and he And he was so appreciative and just felt like this is just incredible from a car company. And so he's offered me, he's like, hey, can I at least just give you a ride back to the dealership or something? Like, you drove here in this car. And he's like, that's quite all right. I've got a Lyft waiting right there, like already for me. And it's like everything was always a step ahead. And so he told this beautiful story about how he hated cars, but he loved Tesla. So it's great. I think it's a great example.
That's great. I'll probably have to get a hat in another month or so. We'll see when the delivery hits.
I had to confess to him, I drive like a 21-year-old clunker. I said, I hate cars too. That hating cars has never translated into spending $80,000 on one. I've never sort of figured out the Tesla leap, but that's for other people, not me, to figure out.
So you're talking about Lippincott, and there's a lot of good insights, blogs and videos. You've done a number of them on the website. One of the concepts you've talked about before I really love is when a leader observes a curious consumer behavior, and there's a difference between when they say that's funny and that's weird. Talk to us about what is different about something being funny or weird.
Gosh, that's one of those things. And sometimes my colleagues, some clients give me a hard time. I have all these like these innovation bumper stickers. I like, that's one of them. And that one, I say that so often that a couple of years ago with another wonderful buddy and colleague of mine, a guy named Eddie Yoon, he and I wrote a little piece for Harvard Business Review on precisely that. You know, one of the stories I love to tell about that is a former client a number of years ago is now the CMO of Pepsi's beverage division, a fellow named Greg Lyons. And at the time, Greg was the brand manager for Mountain Dew. And we've done a lot of work with Pepsi over the years in a variety of capacities. And this was back when I was working for a strategy boutique that Nielsen owned. We knew a lot about Mountain Dew customers, you know, we knew some funny things about it. And that was just sort of coming out of, you know, the typical kind of data you'd see. Like, so we knew that Mountain Dew was really popular with sort of younger millennial males. And we knew that amongst sodas or CSDs, as they call them in the industry, that Mountain Dew really over-indexed in the mornings. Seemed a little curious. And we also knew that Mountain Dew was one of the top selling items in convenience stores, you know, in 7-Elevens or, you know, gas station, whatever. And we're kind of scratching, you know, Greg and his team were sort of scratching his head and saying, you know, like, what all these things point to? They kind of seem odd and maybe we should figure this out or try and just explore, like, what's going on with, you know, these younger guys in convenience stores and mornings. They all come together. And long story short, you know, Greg and his team spent some time kind of immersed in the mornings with these young guys. And what they found is these fellas would leave home, stop at maybe a 7-Eleven, grab an OJ and a Mountain Dew and kind of, you know, pilfer a cup there from the soda stand and mix this kind of funky breakfast cocktail. And off they'd go. And you know, language that, you know, normal people would understand, you know, Greg and his team were asking these guys, like, what are you hiring this, you know, drink to do? You know, very similar to the milkshake story that Clay always used.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of.
You know, and they'd say, well, listen, you know, I've got a job and I want to be, you know, at my best, you know, when I get there, I need a little pick me up. And this Mountain Dew's got a lot of caffeine in it, so that helps. I hate coffee. I can't stand coffee. I've tried it, even tried to like it, can't stand it. But I get the pick-me-up I need from the Mountain Dew. But you know, going into work with like a 20-ounce thing of Mountain Dew, it just doesn't seem professional, so I don't like doing that. The orange juice, I don't know. Like, my mom always gave me orange juice. It kind of feels like morning. It feels like, and you put these things together, and Mountain Dew and OJ, they just go well together, and I put them in my cup and it, you know, does the job really nicely. And you know, the funny thing is I also love energy drinks, but I don't need like this kind of big jolt. I just want to, you know, have energy, you know, so I'm in a good place for work. And you know, it's really interesting if we sort of step out of the scene for a minute. It would have been really easy for Greg and his team to say, wow, this is so interesting. You know, let's do an orange flavored, you know, Mountain Dew or something like that seems logical. But they really pushed further into it to try and understand more and more about what was going on in these fellows' lives. And what they realized, you know, this wasn't just about, say, orange flavored Mountain Dew. And as I started to tell the story, it was really about this ritual transformation of how you go from kind of catatonically asleep to at your best for work. And actually the really important job to be done there around that sort of phase change physically and mentally. And it was a pretty high stakes, you know, important moment in the day. It wasn't just some, you know, throwaway occasion. And this combination, this hack that these guys had created really worked pretty well, but it led to an entirely new brand, in many ways, a new category called Mountain Dew Kickstart, which is now a 2 billion plus brand independent of their Mountain Dew soda business and their Rockstar energy drink business. And it really initially, you know, it sat just perfectly on this, you know, morning transformation. Over time, they actually expanded it into evening transformations where younger guys, before they go out, I guess they do this thing called pre-gaming, for which at my age means you go get your pajamas on. But, you know, for young guys, it means you want a little pick me up before you go out. And so, you know, none of these things said, you know, drink me in the morning or drink me before you go out at night. But they really just sat perfectly in that place where from the perspective of these folks, there was nothing to do. And I just think it would have been so easy for Greg and his team to see these guys mixing Mountain Dew and orange juice and say, that's weird. Like, that's just plain weird. And even if it's kind of interesting, how many people can that actually be, you know? And I think that's a super important point too, right? It's not just that's funny, it's that's weird. It's that, you know, if I can do it on a quick side, Clay had lots of funny quirks. And one of them, he was a dumpster diver, right? So he would drive home from Harvard Business School sometimes and he'd pull into the back of this lumber yard that was sort of on his way home, and he'd root through and take out pieces of wood. And he made beautiful pieces of furniture, but he also made a sign in his office which said anomalies wanted. And that was very purposeful. And to me, this is a great illustration of exactly what Clay had in mind, which is huge innovation opportunities are found in these very faint signals of people doing things in their lives that cause the attentive viewer and listener to pause and say, hey, there's something funny going on there. And that's funny invites you to explore more. Whereas saying that's weird, it almost carries a level of judgment to it. Yeah. You know, it's like, well, that's weird. I can dismiss it. It's unimportant and uninteresting, and I'll move on.
What I love about that story too, when you're talking about the research, is uncovering the functional job of, I've got to have the pick me up in the morning. You've got the social dimension of, right, I need to look professional. I can't walk in with a Mountain Dew. And the emotional is, my mom taught me how to have orange juice in the morning. And it's like something as simple as a breakfast drink has these dimensions. And so it's a great jobs to be done example. And
isn't that funny?
I love it.
So much food, Jay, just to build that. So many things we learn about food, even like fast food work. Like people like go back to, you know, what they did with their parents or what their mom did. I mean, so much. Anyhow, I won't get bogged down in that, but it's incredible. Yeah, you know, sometimes the history and depth of the associations.
Yeah. And we could do maybe a that's funny versus that's weird analysis of your breakfast of choice, Taddy, which is the rumors about ice cream for breakfast with the Taddy Hall.
Well, that's funny.
I'll tell you what is funny. I had a client once, I can probably say it now. This is like 10 years ago. He was an executive at Hershey's, and he had a son who saw me make the case for ice cream for breakfast on some, you know, podcast or video or something. And he sort of used that to make a case with my client's wife that, hey, look, you know, I have this whatever sugary cereal every morning. And if you look at the nutritional characteristics of a bowl of ice cream, really not that different. And he worked out a deal that as long as he was having fruit, he was allowed to have ice cream for breakfast. And my client was like, I don't really know what to say to you. I won't give you the long version, but one thing I will say is this, is that if you look at many of the common breakfast foods, like granola or a muffin, right? I mean, a muffin is just cake reimagined in a socially acceptable form, right? Called a muffin, you know? Same idea with a donut. I mean, let's not kid ourselves, right? Donut is just, you know, a cake or a cupcake of some form, cleverly reimagined as, again, something that's socially acceptable for breakfast. Granola and breakfast bars, they're really just like oatmeal raisin cookies or chocolate chip cookies that, again, have been reconfigured, reimagined, remarketed in socially acceptable ways. So if you think about ice cream's competitors for its dessert job, almost all of ice cream's competitors have been more creative in reimagining themselves in socially acceptable breakfast formats. Yeah. Now, you could argue that maybe ice cream's sad cousin, frozen yogurt, has done that with smoothies. But frozen yogurt is a sad cousin, right? It's not ice cream. So I still, as much as I love my ice cream, sometimes I look at it and like, you got to get your game on. Like all your dinner, your dessert competitors, they've done it and you haven't. And so as a consequence, you know, I'm a little bit of a social pariah. You know, I might be surrounded by people with donuts and, you know, breakfast bars and sugary cereal or whatever. And but if I'm there with my ice cream, independent of the nutritional comparison, I'm seen as like a freak of nature. And I just think that, you know, some combination of just insufficient creativity on the part of ice cream to think about itself in new ways and a lack of imagination on the part of most of my peers to see that this is a perfectly normal thing to do.
Well, Ben and Jerry's and Haagen-Dazs, you need to connect with Lippincott soon and
absolutely
do a rebrand here. So
where is it?
Yeah.
It seems like you could do something about this, Taddy.
Yeah. 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 That's so, the project that I've been waiting for all my life.
So talking a little bit about jobs to be done, where are we in the maturity of jobs to be done in business? It's been around for decades, but it's still new to a lot of people. But you work with a lot of companies, you work with very large companies, so you have a little different perspective on it. What's the prevalence of the mindset in the organization, and where do you think we are with it?
Well, I'd say we're extremely early, right? And what I think Jobs to Be Done has done is it's certainly gained in awareness. Right, it's very, very common that you'll talk to an organization or leaders and they're familiar with the language. It's even relatively common to go in and say, oh yeah, we use that and we're familiar with it and we've done some jobs, we've done stuff. In fact, I would say a decent chunk of the work that we do is with firms who say, you know, we've done it, we've tried it, we've used it, whatever. The challenge is that, and one of the things I often say to folks is that Jobs to Be Done is deceptively complex. Like at the surface level, it's so intuitive. You don't have to learn a new language or special handshakes or fancy formulas, because the essence of Jobs to Be Done is an understanding that in order to be successful in creating products and services that your customers will predictably pull into the flow and fabric of their lives, in order to be successful at that, You actually need access to the raw data, not the modeled, filtered, synthesized data that so many of us take comfort in, of our spreadsheets and models and research reports and analyses. But the raw data on which all those things sit, and the raw data takes the structure and the shape of the individual struggles in which we as people in our personal and professional lives are trying to make progress and create desired experiences. And it's only when we have access to that raw data that we are able to, by decoding those circumstances of desired progress, decoding those struggles, that we are able to see, aha, I now understand the dimensions of experience that are missing or producing anxiety or complicated or impossible. And I know just what I need to do to actually, kind of back to that Tesla story, take those stresses, frustrations, anxieties out of this story and essentially embed them, pull them into my solution to enable that desired progress. And so it's a long way of answering your question, but I think when I go to companies, regardless of what they might say about jobs to be done, in almost every case, if you look at what's the essential unit of their innovation work, the essential unit will be, you know, a product and its particular, you know, performance attributes and characteristics, or it might be a particular customer group and characteristics of that customer. But that's where their innovations typically start, right? With a, hey, we've got to, you know, improve the characteristics or performance of a given, you know, product or set of products, or, you know, hey, there's a group of customers out there and we're going to go after whatever particular group that might be, again, business or personal context. And that it's really that switch of going from product or customer as the essential unit to the circumstance and the circumstance in which a customer is trying to make progress. And very, very, very few organizations have gone through that profoundly unnatural act, right? Of abandoning the focus. Not it doesn't disappear forever. Obviously, you come back and you create products and services, but essentially orienting your innovation journey around a circumstance of struggle rather than attributes of a product or characteristics of a customer.
So it's just hard for an organization to actually elevate the job and the hierarchy of how we organize our thoughts, how we organize our companies over that customer segment and the product segment. That makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, and we always, especially in big companies, as you mentioned this, Jay, is everybody wants things to be big, you know, and so they go out and they look for big markets. And when you do that, what you see, you inevitably, you look for where's their consumption, because that's what we can measure, you know. Incredibly hard to measure non-consumption. It's not impossible. You can often measure it through symptoms or expressions of frustration or, you know, low penetration, or there's a variety of ways you can essentially model or extrapolate, you know, from available data to get a sense of that non-consumption. But all of our tools and our data is a customer. Aha, there's a big growing market. Let's find our way into that big growing market. And the thing about big growing markets, it means that somebody else has already created that market. You know, and I think it goes back to something Drucker said, right? You know, customers are created, you know, and so consumption is essentially the exhaust of somebody else actually providing something of value. And so chasing large growing markets is simply chasing competitors who already have successfully created solutions that are providing value to people in their lives.
Yeah, I think the example that you brought up of Mountain Dew at the beginning is a good example of that, of a company, instead of wanting to just jump forward and say, well, let's just mix orange juice and Mountain Dew, but instead they understood the circumstance a lot better. And that small insight led to something big, rather than looking for something big and then it not working out as they hoped.
Yeah, isn't that right? And once you sort of realize, hey, this isn't about like a new flavor of a drink, but this really is about morning transformations and transitions, the levers you have to sort of pull in terms of thinking about that whole experience, they multiply massively. There's all these different ways that we could do that. And at the same time, what you're solving for gets much, much clearer. And that's how Jobs systematically de-risks innovation.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of that, so here at Atrium Health, we've worked with Bob before on an engagement. We've had him on the podcast several times. We voraciously consume anything that he writes or produces. And we've been trained by him also in doing job student. So a lot of the work that we've done at Atrium Health has had sort of Bob's influence. We'd love to learn about how you and Lippincott approach jobs to be done work with organizations. Are there processes or frameworks that you like to use? And if someone engaged with you, what might that experience be of doing that jobs work, and then how to then apply it to their organizational strategy and how they organize their business units and all of that?
Well, first I got to say, like, if you've had Bob on a number of times, it's a little bit like saying, hey, Moses was here last week. What do you got to add? Wow, I don't know. Another commandment? And I love Bob. I love Bob as a friend, and I admire him massively as a professional. You know, I think the reality is, we never compete, you know, and a large reason for that is, we do things just at a very different scale. So we're almost always working with large multinational organizations, or at least, you know, national leaders. And so a couple of the areas that we end up often going with that is number one, how do you scale the approach across an organization? Number one. Number two is, and you alluded to this, is how do we actually build innovation capabilities? It's one thing to sort of be successful in a project or with an initiative, but how do we actually, as an organization, build that skill set and that mindset, but also then think about creating the capabilities, meaning, you know, the necessary resources, the appropriate processes that animate those resources and make them useful, and then the governance and the metrics and the incentives to operationalize something at scale. And doing that is something that we end up spending quite a bit of time doing, number one. And two goes back to something I mentioned earlier, which is really the intersection of brand and innovation. And jobs to be done, and what we call, you know, kind of what we call go-to brands, that small number of brands that all of us, you know, almost like my buddy Arak, you know, delight in pulling into their lives. And the reason we do that is because those brands, and this is based on a huge amount of research. We're actually, I'm working right now with our other friend Karen Dillon on a piece to articulate this, that integration more fully. But those go-to brands, turns out, not only do they grow five times faster than their peers and perform much better in the recent pandemic downturn than their peers, but they do two fundamentally things that their peers don't do. One is they enable meaningful progress, and progress in terms of basically two attributes: working like magic and advancing my world. And it's actually advancing my world is a more powerful driver of progress than even working like magic, which is interesting. And then the connection driver is be true to me and show that you care. So you actually got to create experiences that not only are you true to me, but you actually are doing things that make a difference in my life and make me feel part of something bigger. In any event, there's an obvious intersection or role for jobs to play and helping brands move from, say, the lower left there of like merely transactional brands to build the connection and enable the progress to move up to the upper right, or brands that maybe have a high degree of connection because we sort of grew up loving them and we've got associations that are favorable with them, but they really haven't done much for us lately. And how do we help them find new dimensions in people's lives where they can make considerable progress? So I think where we spend a lot of time is how do we bring bring integration to the concepts of innovation and brand so that ultimately it gets back to something we talked about in the beginning, that we deliver outcomes for clients that are manifest in the experiences their customers now have with their brand, materially represented in their products and services. But how are those experiences transformed in ways that bring new meaning to the lives of those customers and new value to the client? And it's that integration of innovation activity and a deep understanding of what makes a brand valuable to whether it's business or individual consumers, where we see, I think, you know, tremendous value to be created and where most of our work takes root.
Well, talking about building innovation capability, jobs to be done capability, and scaling it in an organization is really timely for us. We are working with Todd, and you probably talked with Todd about doing exactly that. Let's just talk jobs, for example. We've done some teaching of that. We're starting to get some traction with people using the language, the mindset. But are there certain tips, maybe, what kind of fertilizer do we need, per se, to grow and scale jobs, to get people to buy into the mindset, but also be able to talk to customers, our consumers and patients? Have you seen some success stories in that, or what advice might you have to us?
Well, I do think it is, at least in my experience, it's an apprenticeship craft, you know, right? It's one thing to hear about it. It's one thing to read about it. But the organizations that I've worked with that have been truly successful, and whether you point to an Intuit, which is one that is quite public, you know, they've been on a 20-year journey. You think of like the first public articulation of jobs to be done was an article that Clay and I wrote with Intuit's founder, Scott Cook. And we wrote that 15 years ago as marketing malpractice in 2005. And at that point, you know, Scott and his team were already on this journey at Intuit, and they're still on it, you know? And if you look at the way that mentality is embedded in the way that Intuit works, not only is it essentially a continual presence and a continual evolution, but what Scott would tell you is it's a continuous effort to sort of combat traditional thinking. And I remember once, you know, he told me about going into a meeting with a bunch of senior executives, and they had their reports and stuff and their, you know, KPIs and metrics and readouts. And he asked all of them to take out a highlighter. He said, go through these performance reports that we're about to go through and highlight anything that your customer would really care about. And he said, you know, it was kind of shocking how little yellow there was on many of these pages, you know? And so it's one half of an answer, which is it's always difficult because, and I'll scramble it, but Machiavelli said in The Prince 500 years ago, you know, the innovator has for enemies all those defenders of the old order, and those who might benefit from some new order will be but lukewarm defenders, right? In other words, the core business and the way we've always done things and the way we do things and the way our core business generates revenue and profit today, that exerts a 24/7 invisible force that says, do it this way, do it this way. It's safer, it's smarter, it's better, it's how we've always done it. And so I think it's always requires some, you know, more escape velocity isn't quite the right metaphor, but it's never really a natural act. But I think the way that you do there is that continual commitment, and it's got to be that apprenticeship of letting people experience it. And then it becomes, you know, deeply embedded in their belief system. Because where they get to, and I'll shut up on this, is often you get to a point in a journey where people's, and this happens fairly early, on their personal, I don't want to say road to conversion, where their eyes open and they realize, oh my gosh, we're actually in a totally different business than I thought we were in. And it's that kind of epiphany of, and I can use a salty snacks example, but I'll try and preserve client anonymity here. A fast food breakfast, sandwich. This was a fast food chain that was looking at breakfast, and this was not the milkshake business. It's far, far more recent. And they've always looked at their business through lens of, the products that they're offering and the convenience of how fast the drive-throughs are in the morning. And whenever things sales are kind of slumping, they think, well, is our service slowing down? Do we need to add a new product? Or should we kind of run a promotion or a deal on something? And that was sort of the repertoire. What we found out really quickly and early on in the process was a lot of people have crummy mornings. And having a crummy morning is no fun, and it kind of sets you up for a crummy day. And that's really the huge opportunity out there, is the huge market of people who have crummy mornings. And what can we do to create an experience that allows us to transform these crummy mornings actually into really positive mornings that set up wonderful days and successful days? And once you sort of make that flip, you're like, holy cow, there's a lot of stuff that we can do. And I can't reveal some of those things, but you just be astounded at how much little details. And one thing I can say is, like, for example, like micro conversations between, someone's taking your order and, the guest. Those micro conversations, even at a drive-thru, can make all the difference in the world. And so, and there's lots more to that. But I would say in so many projects, and I'm just talking about something as pedestrian as breakfast, fast food, drive-thru, and I could tell you dozens of these, there's a moment in the project where, a newbie or a client will have that, oh my gosh, we're actually in this business. And therefore, the competition wildly diversifies. But also the market gets much, much bigger. All the people with crummy mornings. Wow. And our share gets much smaller. And the levers that we can actually activate to innovate around helping people have better mornings multiply. And the path forward of how might we, and this is an area we spend a lot of time, co-create with customers to prototype and test and bring to life new products, new services, new experiences embodied in a brand expression that people are thrilled to pull into their lives, because that brand now means a great morning. And now you're not competing with other fast food chains, because there ain't nobody else out there who gives me a great morning the way you do. You really, when you do this right, number one is you realize you're in a different business than you thought you were in. And number two, it opens up the opportunity to change the basis of competition versus your traditional competitive set.
Oh, that's wonderful. Great illustration. Taddy, with the minutes that we have remaining, I wanted to ask one final question.
This is super fun, by the way.
Oh, we could do this all day. Maybe as a final question, is there a brief anecdote or story that you could share, some lesson that you learned from being a student and collaborator with Professor Clay Christensen?
Oh my gosh, that's almost an unfair question. And after he passed, his wonderful assistant had reached out, and she asked each of us to sort of make videos about some of our remembrances of Clay. She was like, just make like a 2-minute video. And I was like, 30 minute video, and then there was the time, there was so much that there's so many gifts and so many moments. It's kind of impossible. I would say, you know, if I had to like boil it down and just sort of pick something at random, I mean, I think one of the things that made him so successful was his profound and totally authentic humility. And he would enter almost any conversation with the conviction that he had nothing useful to say, which was always wrong. He had lots of useful things to say. But what that did is in his mind is he said, you know, when people would come into his office with complex business problems, you know, he would almost certainly say, he'd do a couple things. One is he'd sort of shift his weight around and, you know, and think for a minute. And he'd say, well, you know, I don't really have any idea whatsoever, which kind of took the, you know, went out of sales about this particular situation. And then typically he would tell a story, right? Which was seemingly so irrelevant that you wondered if he heard the question. And then he would sort of make a leap. He's like, you know, as I said, I really don't know much about your business or your question, but I think there's a theory that might have a point of view on this. And he would introduce some construct, you know, like disruption or jobs to be done. And he would sort of say, well, what the theory would say, and he's so humble, he couldn't even take credit for the idea because he would have told a story that sort of made people create some opening in their minds and saying like, you know what, the shape of the answer might look a little bit different than what I'd anticipated. And with that openness and that sort of loosening of their grip on whatever convictions they entered with, he sort of lets a theory kind of float down and kind of puts it there and says, let's just see if this theory might have something to say. And he kind of opens up and he says, you know, here's what I think. And the whole thing almost takes like a story of an adventure, you know? And you could just watch these executives, you know, with rapt attention, like they were 5-year-olds at story hour, you know? And he never tried to convince anyone of anything. You know, it was just, and you could just see these people like, oh my God, I'd never thought about it that way. And he would never tell them the answer. I mean, in some ways it's kind of basic Socratic method, but they would essentially fill in the blank, kind of the way we started at the beginning with fill blank. They say, I get it. You know, so what you're saying, and Clay, like, no, that's the theory saying, is that, you know, if I think about it this way, and in some ways goes back all the way to the original conversations with Andy Grove at Intel and anticipating disruption, same conversation. You know, the theory would say, Andy, that you got to worry about these upstarts coming in. I don't know if they're out there, but that's what the theory would say. With lower cost business models who are able to make this time memory chips that are more than good enough for regular old schmucks like me. And sure enough, it was true. And so it was these constant stories, and they were really, I think, rooted not in his brilliance, which he had and was, but really in his fundamental just goodness and truly authentic humility, that he didn't have all the answers. But if we really invested in creating strong theory, that those theories could help people. And that's all he cared about, was helping people. And that was probably something that was more beautiful about him than anything else. It's like he just didn't, that was really what mattered to him about above all else.
Yeah.
And I miss him every day.
Yeah, we do too. Thank you for that tribute, Taddy. And thank you so much. You've been so generous with your time. This has been an exceptional conversation. We thank you and look forward to seeing breakfast ice cream on the shelves at some point in the next little bit. So
I'm on it.
Awesome. All right.
Thank you, Taddy. This is a lot of fun.
I'll volunteer to to co-create it with you as a consumer.
All right. So. We'll have a jam session. We'll invite Todd in there too. So yeah, I know you've got a super consumer. So nice to spend time with you guys. Thank you so much. Really a pleasure.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Taddy. This is Ben Tingey with Jay Gerhart on a Sherpa's Guide to Innovation podcast. Thanks so much for listening. That I have. I mean, you're sitting there. I don't know if it's a mirror or a picture behind you, but it's like you have this halo behind, around your head.
That goes everywhere with me. Yeah. So
it's this great visual of like the.
It's a mirror.
Like a Renaissance painting or something of a saint.